This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Extremely tense is how St. Joseph's College history professor Susan Chatton describes the relationship between faculty and administrators as the Rensselaer-based college's deadline to suspend operations draws closer. Chatton's one of six tenured faculty members who filed suit against the college, claiming administrators violated their own contracts and policies governing faculty layoffs. The lawsuit contends that the privately owned college promised at least 1 year of severance pay, access to retirement and benefits plans, and also help in finding a new job. But subsequent to St. Joseph's February announcement that operations would cease because the college can't pay its bills, Professor Chatton says that tenured faculty still haven't been told when their last day of employment would be or the amount of severance pay and benefits that they're set to receive. She says that some professors are teaching additional condensed courses to ensure that students have the required credits to graduate on time.
It's extremely tense. That's one of the reasons we did the lawsuit, is we can't get answers. We're very frustrated. I personally feel a sense of betrayal by the administrators that we're not being given more information and help in more concrete ways.
Professor Chatton says that the college is contradicting its commitment to provide a one-year advance notice of layoffs as well as the severance pay and the access to benefits.
We don't even know what our last date of employment is, for example. We don't know how much our severance is going to be, when it's going to start and end. We have had one thing told to us in person and another given to us in writing, both of which are different from what our contracts say.
Chatton says she's a St. Joe alumna and nearing the end of her career, and she feels being betrayed after working nearly 30 years as a professor at the private college in Rensselaer. And she's hoping that a judge will provide some clarity to the layoff process sometime soon, at least as to what to expect and, in her case, how to be able to plan for the future. April is Child Abuse and Neglect Awareness Month in Indiana. Hoosier children are more than likely to be the victims of abuse and neglect than their peers nationally at the rate of 17 per 1,000 kids. And the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, Tammy Silverman, says that the data behind the causes and the problems itself, one of the things being focused on during the month as well. You can find out more about this month of Child Neglect and Awareness Month in Indiana by going to the Indiana Youth Institute website, IYI.org. The website MoneyRates.com just released its list of best state for millennials. And Richard Barrington with Money Rates spent some time talking with us about how Indiana came in at number 10 in the country. He started out the conversation with how the data was compiled for the report.
We look at studies like this as being kind of cliche busters. There are a lot of popular impressions about what type of places might attract young people to live. But sometimes those popular impressions aren't borne out by the facts. So we looked at eight different factors, eight things that are measurable and objective, ranging everything from economic factors to lifestyle type factors. And we kind of combined all those rankings to come up with an overall ranking of the best and worst states for millennials.
Well, let's take a look now at Indiana. What seem to be some of the best things for millennials as far as the data and the report is concerned?
As you know, of the 50 states plus the District of Columbia, Indiana came in at number 10, which is really strong to make the top 10. And some of the particular points of strength: Indiana was one of the top ranked states for the availability of high-speed broadband. It also ranked in the top 10 for both the availability and the affordability of residential rentals. And that's something we consider significant for this study because most young adults are more likely to be renters than homeowners.
When you take a look at the data and you've looked at some positive points, what seem to be some negative points as far as Indiana is concerned for millennials?
Well, interestingly, the one area I would say that Indiana really fell down was it did not rate well in terms of the number of fitness facilities relative to the size of its young adult population. As I mentioned, we looked at a couple of lifestyle-related things along with the economic factors, and the concentration of fitness facilities was one of them. So if working out is your thing, Indiana might not be your top choice.
Now, since you have that topic to bring up, and we talk about the fact that there aren't quite as many fitness centers in Indiana to suit most millennials, I guess we talk about the problems of health issues. Do we find that maybe because of this lack of the number of healthcare facilities or health fitness facilities, rather, in Indiana, do you think that's going to cause a problem, or is showing to cause a problem as far as millennials' health is concerned?
Not necessarily. I mean, lifestyle choices come down to a number of different things. This is also occupation is a big factor in personal health as well. But it's more just a question of giving people an indication, depending on what their personal priorities are, of what different states' strengths and weaknesses might be.
So it still looks pretty promising, I guess, for millennials, certainly in Indiana. And I know that we do see, of course, a shift of people living in other states coming to Indiana. In particular, we're talking about around Chicago and other parts of northern Illinois coming to live in Indiana. They like it, the conditions here for the most part. Certainly, if, like you say in the report, that millennials are interested in rentals. We need more of those, and I know that's certainly one of the things in the works that the housing markets here in Northwest Indiana are looking forward to. Is there anything else that you think that that maybe in a future report that you'll focus in on as far as millennials are concerned?
No, those are really, right now, some of the other things that we focus on that we haven't mentioned were the employment rate for young adults, the overall youthfulness of a state. Young people typically like to be around other young people, and the affordability of education, the cost of state schools for 4-year degrees for in-state students. And Indiana came in around the middle of the pack on all of those issues. And so those neither kind of pulled it up or dragged it down.
That is MoneyRates.com analyst Richard Barrington talking about Indiana ranking 10th in the best states for millennials rankings that came out recently. Hoosiers will see more farm equipment in the fields and on the roads to those fields in the weeks ahead as spring corn and soybean planting ramps up. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek has more today on farmers' hopes for their cash crops this planting season.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture expects farmers in Indiana and nationwide to plant more soybeans than ever this year, while corn acreage looks to hold steady. Purdue University agronomist Bob Nielsen says corn prices are still lackluster, with plenty in storage, and that's driven soybean prices up.
That's what's encouraged some folks to shift some of their intended corn acreage into soybean acreage this year.
Nielsen says planting is off to a good start, with no problems looming. Even rain delays didn't hurt the eventual harvest last year. Still, Nielsen says hardy crops need a strong start, especially as climate changes promise wilder weather.
It makes it even more important than ever to try to grow a crop that's uniform and vigorous to begin with, and then that may tolerate some of these extreme weather events a little bit better and not lose as much yield.
Weather permitting, Nielsen expects most Hoosier farmers will get their corn and soybeans in the ground by the end of May. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in West Lafayette.
The 2017 legislative session was defined largely by a single issue, road funding. Although other issues had surfaced, lawmakers kept their eyes on a long-term infrastructure plan. Indiana Public Broadcasting's State House reporter Brandon Smith tells us what lawmakers accomplished and what they didn't in the 2017 session.
The legislative focus of this year's session wasn't a mystery. Lawmakers already spent more than a year debating road funding, and so it wasn't a surprise when Governor Eric Holcomb told the General Assembly this in the first weeks of session.
I will work with you to establish a plan that invests in the new projects for the future that ensures Indiana will remain the crossroads of America.
But it was not the only big goal or debate this session. A number of education issues garnered significant attention, including groundwork to replace the I-STEP and changing the state superintendent from an elected to appointed position. The General Assembly also doubled annual money for state-funded preschool, a move Speaker Brian Bosma celebrated.
A $44 million investment in pre-K education during the biennium, that was one of our top priorities for this session.
Lawmakers also broke up an e-liquids or vaping industry monopoly they'd created, one that led to legal action and an FBI inquiry. And as Republican Senator Randy Head told his colleagues, a federal court ruling in January invalidating most of Indiana's e-liquid rules only heightened the pressure.
If we don't implement Senate Bill 1, there will be no regulations, and it will be easier for people who want to do bad things to put illegal substances in e-liquid and ship it here, there, and anywhere else.
Then there were the controversial social issues that seem to happen every year. One bill sent to the governor dealt with parental notification of abortion. Republican Senator Erin Houchin said her bill was aimed at strengthening parental rights.
It just requires that parents be involved in these critical decisions that affect their minor children.
The bill originally required parents be notified if their child sought abortion consent from a judge. It raised concerns about confidentiality and, as Republican Senator Vanita Becker said, grim consequences.
All this bill will do is encourage back alley abortions.
The House made it the judge's job to determine whether parents are notified, and only after the judge grants or denies the consent. Some measures drew attention when they didn't pass. In the Senate, a bipartisan push to pass a hate crimes bill wasn't called down for a floor vote. Democratic Senator Tim Lannon summed up supporters' sentiments.
I'm very sorry that we couldn't find the courage in this body to take this matter up. I guess we'll say again, maybe next year.
And in the House, a bill reforming Indiana's redistricting process, backed by Bosma, couldn't even get a vote in committee. The speaker was blunt about its failure.
Some of the members of the Elections Committee had a lot of questions about it, not convinced it would have come out of committee if it had had a vote.
And then there was alcohol, the issue no one saw coming, and leadership wasn't happy showed up. Convenience store owner Jay Ricker acquired restaurant permits for two of his convenience stores. Those permits allowed him to sell cold beer and hard liquor for carryout, previously a right reserved almost solely for liquor stores. That provoked a swift response from lawmakers like Bosma.
We're definitely addressing their permits, which are significantly different than anything that the ATC had issued before.
Their final solution was to keep the status quo for all existing permit holders, except Ricker's, which will likely lose its licenses next year. As one might expect, Jay Ricker wasn't happy.
I'm just shocked that they won't listen, and it appears that the leadership in many cases has singled us out.
But in the end, everything circled back to road funding, and after months of haggling, legislators agreed on a tax-raising, fee-creating, revenue-producing infrastructure plan. Senate President Pro Tem David Long was effusive in his praise.
But we're not kicking the can down the road. We're taking responsibility for what we need to do for today and for tomorrow in this state so we don't dump this debt and this problem on our kids. I'm very proud of that.
Praise for the bill isn't universal, though. Taxpayer advocacy groups argued the measure's tax hikes were unwarranted, with some pledging retribution at the ballot box. But that opportunity won't come until next year, and Speaker Bosma says the legislature will already be moving on to their next challenge. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith. At the State House.
The city of Valparaiso is turning to two contractors to develop some studies this summer that will eventually lead to safer and more efficient travel around the city. Engineering Department Director Tim Berkman told us recently about the work that will be funded by Federal Highway Administration grants.
There was a call for projects put out by NERPC last year, noting that there were some safety funds available and seeking some safety projects. So the city put together a couple of applications, one to do road safety audits on 10 of our key primary corridors, and then the other one to look at our 33 traffic signals, specifically with respect to the timing and optimization of those traffic signals. And both of those fit well within the criteria of the projects that they were seeking at NERPC. And so we were subsequently awarded some funding, and that's what we recently brought to our Board of Works with the contracts from DLZ for the road safety audits and American Structure Point for the traffic signal timing and optimization project.
Tell us what each of the companies is going to be working on in their respective parts of the projects.
Right. So the road safety audit project is going to look at our 10 primary corridors, which total about 25 miles in length. And the idea is to look at things like accident history, traffic statistics, you know, volumes and turning movements, and identifying where some of our key safety issues, where accidents are occurring, where key safety issues need to be addressed, and looking at things like intersection site distance or the ability to accommodate all users of the roadway, are the pedestrian curb ramps in compliance? Is there ADA access to all of our bus stops, appropriate ADA access? And just looking holistically at our corridors to identify improvements for not only motorists, but pedestrians and cyclists as well. And so they'll be looking at those comprehensively, identifying lists of projects that that we can tackle either locally on a small scale or on larger scale, what we may need to seek additional grant funding for through the federal aid process. Mm-hmm. So we'll come away with lists of projects that have cost estimates, benefit cost ratios, and prioritize each of these projects for us, so that the city will have a master plan essentially to work from in terms of safety improvements to our roadways.
Now, Tim, you mentioned that many of the major routes in Valparaiso were going to be reviewed as part of this. What are some of the streets and roads that are going to be looked at here?
Sure. The 10 include Sillhavy Road, Burlington Beach Road, Calumet Avenue, Campbell Street, Lincoln Way, Vail Park, State Road 2 through the city limits, Roosevelt Road, LaPorte Avenue, and Harrison Boulevard.
Well, it's just about all the major streets in Valparaiso, isn't it? Or pretty close
Correct.
To it, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, that was the idea behind the application, was to cover our primary corridors. Yeah.
Is this, I guess, a way to be able to deal with the price of success, I suppose, in the city of Valparaiso, that Valparaiso has grown so much? Not only are more people living in the area, they're traveling on the roads to get to businesses, to schools, Valparaiso University, for example. We're finding that these roads are being more heavily traveled. They need to be reviewed more?
Sure. I mean, with growth comes additional traffic, and as developments occur and as residential areas are building out, we're certainly seeing the associated traffic growth on our roadways and primary corridors. And so with that, it's always important to look back and identify any deficiencies and look at, like I said, accident stats and histories to try to identify safety improvements.
Now, I know it's not related necessarily to this project, although I'm sure it will be in the future tied to how the studies turn out. But are there any of these streets that you've mentioned here up for any kind of work that's going to be done this summer?
Calumet Avenue between Bullseye Lake and Burlington Beach Road, we'll be doing some pavement widening to add curbs and also some additional turn lanes, and then add a pathway along the east side of that corridor connecting into our overall pathway system. That project will happen this year, and then next year, the intersection of Sillhavy and LaPorte will be reconstructed to include a roundabout at that intersection. And there's other projects planned further down the line on some of these other corridors.
I imagine, too, that all of the studies that are done here to look into how efficient traffic's moving in through the entire city on these major routes are probably going to help in the future when it comes time to start planning for any road improvements.
Absolutely, and that's part of the justification for this study, too, is to give us some information and help us plan for future projects. Having the information from this study will be utilized on future grant applications to show that we've done our homework and looked at an analysis of these corridors and use that to help support future requests for grant funding.
That's Valparaiso City Engineering Director Tim Berkman. The Judicial Nominating Committee announced on Wednesday that the finalists that Governor Eric Holcomb will choose from to be able to choose the 110th Supreme Court Justice on the bench. After about 7 hours of deliberations, on the heels of 2 days interviewing the 11 semifinalists, the commissioner announced three finalists: Clark County Judge Vicki Carmichael, Wabash County Judge Christopher Goff, and Boone County Judge Michael Kincaid. Chief Justice Loretta Rush, who chairs the Judicial Nominating Committee, says that the final decision was a tough one, and she says factors that went into choosing the three finalists vary widely. The finalists are vying to replace retiring Indiana Supreme Court Justice Robert Rucker, a native of Gary, who steps down after 26 years on the bench. Governor Eric Holcomb will have about 60 days to name his choice for that seat. Our next guest is a fellow who is a longtime editor and travel writer. He's written, in fact, 11 travel guides, most of them for states outside of Indiana, but still just the same. You can catch them as well. He's had articles published in Chicago Reader and Reader's Digest and the like, and he's also talked about travel and culture in the area. Jerome Polin is the author of a new book involving interesting things to check out here in Northwest Indiana and the entire Hoosier State, for that matter. The book is entitled Oddball Indiana, a guide to 350 really strange places. In fact, this is the second edition. And as I recall, I did the math here when I was taking a look at the book here over the weekend. And if I recall right, the first edition was 13 years ago.
Yes, it was.
That was not an unlucky number, I hope. At least it hasn't been so far, I'm sure. So it was 2007 when the first edition of Oddball Indiana came out. And now the second edition is in print. You can check it out. It's published by the folks at the Chicago Review Press. And Jerome Polin, is here in the studio. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
What gave you the idea to do a second edition? Was it just time to do an update on some of the places that you mentioned in the first one, or did you learn from your sources about some new places to put in the book?
Well, a little of both. Over time, a lot of these places are very small. They might have two or three visitors a day. Some of them burn to the ground or someone moves away. And the more I learned about what had happened to the old sites, it needed a refresher. And the first book did very well, and people had contacted me and gave me ideas about new sites to go see. Mm-hmm. So it expanded from there.
I know that one of the places that had been, in the first edition that is not in the second, but you note the fact that it's already gone, is here in Northwest Indiana, the Oz Museum in Chesterton.
Right.
That was pretty sad learning when you learned that one's had disappeared already.
Absolutely. But since then, they added a Orville Redenbacher statue
That's
in
right.
Chesterton.
That's
so
right.
It was replaced in a different location.
Let's take a look at some of the places. We'll start out first here in Lake County. One of the places that many people know about, it's been certainly the topic of trips and tours for a long, long, long time, has been the Marktown neighborhood in East Chicago. What got you the idea to check that out? Did somebody tell you about that ahead of time and say, you got to try and drive through this area?
Yes, it's sort of difficult to find because it's sort of wedged between the steel mills and some of the refineries there, and Marktown was a community that was devised by Howard Van Doren Shaw, and it was based on European architecture. But it wasn't exactly very practical because the streets are so narrow that people have to park their cars on the street. So my entry about this is, park on the sidewalk and walk in the street. It's a very strange looking place. It's a little bit, long in the tooth, run down a bit. I had heard that they were possibly going to be expanding a refinery, when I went there and visited, for the second edition, still there.
I think it's maybe the talk has just gone around the neighborhood. I'm sure the BP refinery would still like to claim some of the property, and I know it's getting dangerously close to the residents, which is one reason I think why they wanted to get if they do take over to use it as expansion area for the refinery, they'd ask people to move out just for safety's sake, I would imagine. So,
but it looks like an old European village when you're driving through there, a little
rundown.
It's very
neat. The first time I think I ever heard about this notoriety was something was in a Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Oh, okay.
Column that when it's actually Mr. Ripley drew a little depiction of what some of the streets in Marktown were like. It's very interesting to check out. The book talks about all kinds of things, and you have to take a look at the whole book to get the real feel. Even if you just focus in on the Northern Indiana part of the book, there's a lot in here about cows, and that's not only about the new version of cows, so to speak, there at Fair Oaks Farm, south of us here, off I-65, but also some cows that have been hanging around for a long time. Tell us about the cows.
Well, every time that I ran across a fiberglass cow in the state, I added it to a list. So there's actually a list of, I think, about a dozen different fiberglass cows that you can find. I think there's one on top of Swiatek's.
Yes, right. That's the place that's on Broadway in Merrillville. That's one you see there right on top of there. In fact, it's perched right next to their sign where they advertise the specials.
Right.
That's one place, too. And I know there's another one, I guess, the Howard and Sons Meat Market on Ridge Road.
Okay,
Munster is another place too. That's another great place.
And as you're heading down in south on 65, you'll see quite a few of them leading to Fair Oaks Farms.
Tell us, if you will, about some of the spots in Gary that you saw that were interesting enough that ought to be mentioned in the book, Oddball, Indiana.
Well, of course, there are the Michael Jackson sites from the Michael Jackson family. When the book first came out, there was no marker at the Jackson family house, which is on Jackson Street, but not named after the Jackson family. Now they have a large memorial that's out in front of this house, and you can also visit where the family went to the Jehovah Witnesses Kingdom Hall and the ruins of the old Lucky Lounge.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Let's take a look now here in Griffith. There's only one entry for the city of Griffith that's in the book here, but it's one that I think if people have never seen before, they ought to check it out. And you've entitled it American Natural Resources. And I know that it's one of the places where I guess that people probably drive past and think it's always just big open land, but there's something actually to see there.
Right. Yeah, it's a taxidermy shop. And if you go in there, you can see very strange taxidermy specimens. You see raccoons that are rowing along in canoes and things like that.
Looking into Porter County now, in Valparaiso, there are quite a few spots there that are noted in the book as well, too. Of course, we mentioned just one at the beginning of our conversation, the Orville Redenbacher statue. Mm-hmm. Who tipped you off to that?
That one actually was in the news. One of the things that I do, I have a file for every state in the union because I'm constantly putting out new books. So every time I hear some strange news, I will clip out the article or jot a note to myself, and I'll stick it in the I'll stick it in the envelope or the file folder for each one. And when the Orville Redenbacher statue was erected, there was actually quite a bit of news in the Chicagoland area about this statue that was put up, and now it's in a park. It's downtown.
I imagine that you probably get notes from people, at least from the first edition, who have gotten a copy. They've checked out the places and gotten back with you and said, yeah, I did drive by there. I did check that out. And one place I know in particular that is a longstanding tourist attraction, although it's only available to see occasionally, is the House of Tomorrow. In fact, there's a Logs to Lestrens tour again coming up here early next month, where people, if you get your tickets from Indiana Landmarks, you can actually get a chance to even walk into some of these places. Tell us about what importance the House of Tomorrow and the other houses that are nearby are like.
Well, they were done for the Chicago World's Fair, and after the fair was over, they were moved across the lake and put up along the shore there in Beverly Shores. But they also have some historic recreations, so they'll have the Old North Church. That one is now a private residence, but you can see from the outside that it looks like the Old North Church. Mm-hmm. And then some of the buildings were designed and built to demonstrate new materials, so asphalt shingling or they had different purposes for these houses. So some of them, they might look not so modern today because these building materials have been incorporated, but the House of Tomorrow still looks like a futuristic sort of a wedding cake shaped house. Mm-hmm. that's right there on the shore there.
Okay. In La Porte, of course, is the historic spot where you don't see much of it anymore, where Belle Gunness, the notorious murderess of La Porte, lived. And what tipped you off to put that in the book?
Well, she's a groundbreaker, as I put. she is known as America's first serial killer. She advertised in Lonely Hearts magazines and would get guys to come down and visit her, and she's like, don't tell your family where you're going, come and visit me and we'll get married and bring your life insurance policy at the same time. And there are quite a few men fell for this. Mm-hmm. And she had a farm outside of town, and these men would disappear, and she would somehow have come into additional money. And when she was eventually found out, or when people started to get suspicious, some of the family members of the men that disappeared, her farm burned down, and there was a body that was found in there that they claimed it was Belle, but the more they looked into it, it seemed like it wasn't Belle actually after all, and that maybe she escaped justice and went to parts unknown, and no one ever saw her again.
We're talking with Jerome Poland, who is the author of the second edition of the book, which is entitled Oddball, Indiana. a guide to 350 really strange places, and there are some really strange places you have to check the book and see there. They're not all in Northwest Indiana, but that will give you a good, one-tank trip, I suppose. If you live up here, you'll make a trip down to Indianapolis and want to check some of these places out. John Dillinger, the notorious gangster, who, of course, met his fate outside a famous theater in Chicago. Also known, too, for his exploits as a bank robber with his gang in Northwest Indiana and other places as well, has a special section in this book. Tell us about the Diapers to Death tour, as you kind of put it in the book.
Right. He was born in Indianapolis, and so I trace everything from his birth in Indianapolis, when he was growing up in Mooresville, Indiana, which is southwest of Indianapolis, where he committed his first crime and ended up in the Pendleton facility. He asked to be transferred to the Michigan City facility because they had a baseball team. Mm-hmm. And that's where he met all the gang members that would become known as the Terror Gang, doing bank robberies in the 1930s. I try to include as many confirmed Dillinger heists that took place within the borders of Indiana in the book as possible, and of course I also include the famous escape that he made from the Lake County Jail in Crown Point. Mm-hmm. And that is now open for tours. If you go to their website, you can find out the times, and they're actually open. And then just in the courthouse across the street, they have the Dillinger collection, where you can see the wooden gun, and you can see the wicker basket where he was put in the morgue in Chicago, in the Cook County morgue, after he was shot outside the Biograph Theater.
I understand, too, that the John Dillinger Museum that has been set up and just opened up here not long ago also has a special feature of honoring law enforcement officers and officials who died in the line of duty, to remember them, showing that the crime doesn't pay.
Nope.
unfortunately, one of the people that you note in the book here, too, from one of the bank robberies in East Chicago is a police officer who died in the line of duty, I guess, as he was confronted Mr. Dillinger out there.
Correct. And the Indiana State Police also have a large collection of the guns that were apprehended in his various that got dropped along the way, and you can visit those down in Indiana.
The book has three sections, basically Northern Indiana, Central Indiana, and Southern Indiana. It has a lot of great, interesting things to check out here if you've never known about such things as the world's first pay toilets, which are located in Terre Haute. Also, some interesting things, too, about Terre Haute, besides the fact that the Holman Company, which, of course, makes, I guess, among other things, baking powder, but of course spawned the family for the people that took over the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, which is another big Indianapolis entry. Mm-hmm. You've got to check out the museum at the Speedway track. I know that's a beautiful place. If you're really into racing, that's a place to check out. What impressed you when you were there?
Well, I really enjoyed taking the tour in the bus. You can it's worth the extra money to take the tour of the track. You get in a little shuttle bus and it goes around the track. And I think that they say by the time it takes you to go around the track once, one of the race cars would have gone around 17 times.
Wow. Just some interesting things here. Following on to what we mentioned about John Dillinger, he's buried in a cemetery on the north side of Indianapolis. And the folks that put him 6 feet under, maybe actually deeper than that, wanted to be sure that nobody could get their hands on him at any time. Tell us about the special precautions that the gravediggers took to make sure that nobody seems to tamper with Mr. Dillinger's body.
Right. They were worried that people would either try to dig him up for souvenirs. So what they did is they put him in this enormous cement-lined vault, and then they poured quite a bit of cement on top of it. That actually hasn't, though, prevented people from stealing his headstone, and mm-hmm. I think he's on about the third or the fourth headstone by this time. The same thing happened with James Dean. You know, I think he's about on mm-hmm. a third or fourth headstone at this point.
Yeah, and you find a lot of things in there about James Dean and a lot of other people, too, that are noted in the book, which, once again, is entitled Oddball Indiana, A Guide to 350 Really Strange Places, and it's been written and a lot of the photographs in it by our guest today, Jerome Poland. Jerome, thank you for coming by. It's interesting talking with you. If you'd like to check out the book, you can go on the Chicago Review Press website. website and find out more about it as well. Thank you for stopping by to talk about the book, and we hope we have a chance to stop back through the area again, and maybe with the third edition, we'll have a chance to talk.
I don't doubt it.
Thank you. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. A Purdue University Northwest faculty member is looking into how preschoolers best learn how to count. And assistant psychology professor Lori Peterson told us recently that she took advantage of the soon-to-close Riley Child Center on the Hammond campus to put her theories to the test.
I've been working on children's counting skills since I was at graduate school at Notre Dame. I started getting interested in this topic of children's, the knowledge that they come to school with. In college, I heard about data sets that suggested that American children underperformed same-age children in other countries. And so I was very interested in figuring out what we could do as instructors, as researchers, to try to combat that trend. And one really important piece of research came out in 2007 from a research group suggesting that the knowledge that children have about math by the time that they start school not only predicts their math performance throughout elementary school, throughout childhood, it also predicts their reading knowledge, too, so their reading ability, their achievement. And we know that the kids who start off, by the time they start first grade, by the time they start kindergarten with good math skills, those kids are more likely to graduate high school and go on to college. So I was really interested in starting out early on in life. And so one of the first math skills that children learn is counting. What we researchers in developmental psychology, which is the research area that I'm in, in my field of research, one thing that we know is that there's very little research done on counting in particular. So we don't know very much about the conditions, the particular counting practice settings that are most effective for kids. Like, so at home or at school, should children be using counting books, which are highly available, or should they be doing different types of objects as counters? Mm-hmm. When you go into a supply store that supplies teachers with materials that they can use in their classrooms, there's a whole bunch of different varieties that teachers can choose from. So they can choose from really relatively plain disc-like counters to use to help their children practice counting, or they can use really interesting ones like little animals or little pieces of fruit to help them practice counting. So teachers have a lot of choices available to them, but they have relatively little guidance in terms of what might be most effective for them.
Do you think we need more books that might help to kind of get away from the object counting?
That's what my research suggested in graduate school. So for my dissertation, that's exactly what I studied. I was really interested in whether it's better for children, whether children learn more from their counting practice when they're practicing with books or when they're practicing with actual objects. And that's what my research suggested in my dissertation study. It suggested that those children who practice with counting books, they tend to learn more from this counting practice. So they become better at counting, actually, at the end of my study, at the end of the intervention. And so what I wanted to do here in Hammond is I wanted to repeat the same study, but do it a little bit more naturally. In my dissertation, I had a very controlled study, and when children were practicing with objects, they were practicing with objects that were kind of contained on a sheet of paper to make it as similar to the book condition as possible. But what I worried about as a researcher is that if children are practicing with objects on a piece of paper, it's a little unnatural compared to how children would typically practice with objects. And so that's what I've been working on here at the Riley Center. With 10 children so far, although I'm hoping to work with more children this summer and into the next semester, this next fall as well.
We're,
We're talking with assistant psychology professor Lori Peterson, who is a professor at Purdue University Northwest on the Hammond campus. She's also a native of Michigan City, so she has an interest in what region kids are doing and how they're learning, in particular how they learn how to count and what kind of skills those counting skills will bring them when they start studying a more math concepts, especially as they go on through elementary school and into high school as well. Professor Peterson, from what you have found so far, you notice that maybe that the book learning might do better than doing the actual object counting. How can this apply to future skills that students will pick up in higher classes, either through elementary school, in learning their math concepts?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So first I would say that the reason why counting is so important is because it's considered a foundational skill in math. So you need to understand how to count to three, for example, or what exactly three is in order to add it to two to get to five. So you need to know how to count to do arithmetic. So it's foundational in that sense. But what does it say about the types of objects that we should use in classrooms later on in school for later math topics? Well, that is an ongoing question.
And that is Purdue University Northwest professor Lori Peterson. On this Monday, here's John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Mark Baer, Associate Professor of Acting and Directing at Indiana University Northwest, Theater Northwest.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. So we're going to talk about your 10-minute play festival, of course, but
yes.
You're going through a big transition there right now.
That's right. Well, for the entirety of my 6 years at Indiana University Northwest, the performing arts has been housed with fine arts off campus at a Grant Street location,
right.
A temporary facility. We've called it Theater Northwest on Grant, mm-hmm. at 3660 Grant Street.
Mm-hmm.
And
it used to be a grocery store.
That's right, a grocery store. And our theater building used to be a Hollywood Video, I believe.
Sexy.
Right. And so over the last 5 years or so, the state has granted $45 million to Indiana University Northwest to replace Tamarack Hall, right. which listeners will remember. We have a new arts and sciences building, mm-hmm. opening up on Broadway, right on the main campus.
Mm-hmm.
That building will include a 500-seat main stage,
mm-hmm.
A 100-seat flexible studio theater, and all the supporting performing arts facilities. So we're moving from our little Hollywood Video, mm-hmm. Back to a really state-of-the-art facility.
That's fantastic. I remember when Tamarack Hall opened, it was sort of like when I made my premiere on Earth, and it was right around the same era, and the lady who lived across the street from us played Agnes Gooch in a Gary Player's production of Auntie Mame.
Oh.
On the Tamarack Hall stage.
Well, I've heard so many good memories of that space, and
yeah.
I only got to see it post-flood.
Yeah.
So I was there, and I saw the 600 seats and the kind of very high proscenium stage.
Right.
Our new stage will be of a similar size, like I said, 500 seats,
mm-hmm.
but a semi-thrust with very stadium seating to bring those
That's
500
nice.
People as close. It's going to feel very modern, different from most other theaters in Northwest Indiana.
And the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra performed at the old Tamarack Hall a lot and is going to help open the opening weekend.
That's right. Chancellor Lowe will be hosting on August 25th. He'll be hosting our dedication ceremony, and then that evening he's sponsoring a performance of the Northwest Indiana Symphony. That'll be the first performance in the new space.
Yeah, great. And our first performance in Gary in a long time, too.
Yeah.
But anyway, where we started. So tell us about this 10-minute play festival.
Yeah. Well, it's a really exciting time at IU Northwest in performing arts. Oh, our department is growing leaps and bounds. We're up to 20 or 25 majors and minors in addition. And so they've been working hard this semester. My directing one class and my acting two class work together on creating 10-minute plays that are chosen and entirely student-produced. So we'll have seven 10-minute plays. That adds up to about a 90-minute show with transitions and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
They're really diverse. Some of them are dramatic and intense, and some of them are comic, and some of them are political, and it's one of my favorite events because it's just, you know, entirely student-driven and always surprising in that way to me.
How long does it take for the students to prepare these one-act productions?
Right. Well, they've been working on it all semester. Each 10-minute play, I recommend the directors schedule about 20 hours of rehearsal for the 10-minute play, you know, leading up over the 4 or 5 weeks going up. But the process starts even before that when the students go through a mock professional audition process, right? The director, I teach the directors how to run an audition and the actors how to prepare for an audition. And we run it just like they were in Chicago with their, you know, an actor has a 5-minute time slot and has to present a monologue and all of that. Mm-hmm. So that is all part of the experience of working together.
How many students are involved in the whole festival?
At least 25. Okay. At least 25. And we even have a couple of community members who are in casts in addition to that.
Oh, that's neat. Mm-hmm. Wow. So, okay, when does it go up?
The dates are next week, April 28th and 29th at 7:30. And the performances are free. So you can make reservations. If you want to be sure that you have a seat, you can make reservations by going to iun.edu/theater. Mm-hmm. The performances are free to the public.
And if I'm a high school student in Northwest Indiana, how can I learn more about Theater Northwest?
Well, we really want you to come learn about us. Again, that website, iun.edu/theater. But you can make an appointment with our secretary, Sherry Sweeney, at 219-980-6810. That number's on the website, of course. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to meet with anybody interested. We have scholarships available, and this program is onward and upward with a new facility and lots of positive energy.
Right here in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah.
This great theater program. That's great.
I'm telling you, compare us to Chicago schools. We are very affordable and very personable.
Great. Well, thanks, Mark, for being here to tell us about the festival and the plans coming. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
That's John Kane talking with Mark Bayer, who's an associate professor of acting and directing at Indiana University Northwest, about IUN's upcoming 10-minute play festival, which is April 28th and 29th at Theater Northwest on the Gary campus. Tune in next Monday for another Eye on the Arts conversation here on Regionally Speaking. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.